So the beginning of the summer is for me a sort of taking stock time. As I get ready to take a few weeks off to recharge and refresh, I spent some time this last couple of weeks looking back over what we've done in this church year, what I've said, how we've changed, the ways in which you've touched each other's lives. And one thing I did was look back on the sermons I preached, and I stumbled across one just before Christmas that I had forgotten about, and I pulled it out and started to reread it. It was a sermon about the feeding of the 5,000. And as I was reading this thing over, I kept thinking to myself, dang it, Nancy, you seem to have missed the point. And this is not the sort of thing that one can let lie. And so, I am going to tell you the point I missed that Sunday. Because it's never too late. Anyway, I preached it, and you might remember the story. Jesus mourning the death of his dearest friend, John the Baptist. He goes out in the middle of this Galilean nowhere in an effort to get away from it all. And the people just keep following him. You know, multitudes, 4,000, 5,000, we don't know how many, just that there were a lot. And they followed him, and the one thing we know is that they all missed lunch. And the apostles gathered somewhere over in the corner with furrowed brows and flailing gestures, and one could almost imagine what they were saying. What are we going to do, guys? All these people followed us here, and we've got nothing to feed them. Anarchy just about to surface, disaster around every corner, failure and fear and scarcity hovering around like a cloud. And eventually one of them came up to Jesus and told him about the problem. And here's where I get to the point I missed. And the point is about gratitude, see? And the story tells us that when all these anxious people came up to Jesus, he basically said, "So what have you got?" And he gathered up the 7 loaves or 5 loaves or who knows how many loaves, depend on which gospel you read, and the half dozen fishes, the meager offerings of frightened people. He told everybody to sit down for dinner. And he said thank you for everything that was there before him. Though he was weary and the work exhausted him, he said thank you. Though the people asked of him that which he was not sure he had the strength to give, he said thank you. Though their gifts were meager and their demands were great, the first words out of his mouth were, "Thank you." He broke the loaves into pieces, and he gave them to the disciples, and he told them to go out to the crowd and feed those who were hungry, and you know how it goes. At the end, there were 12 baskets full of scraps, and yada yada, and everybody had their fill. Remember? The point is this. He didn't wait for the miracle to happen in order to start singing God's praise. He didn't even wait for a world in which things were going according to plan to start giving thanks. There in that place, mourning the loss of his best friend and yearning for nothing but a moment's peace, he began with neither his sorrow, nor his yearning, nor his fear, nor the utter scarcity that everyone else was obsessed with, but with his gratitude. And out of that, the people received everything they needed. How often do we all meet either the divine or the people we love or another day with the leading edge of our fear and our hurt, our weariness, our insecurities, with the myriad ways in which we personally have been wronged and the illimitable sufferings of this oil-slicked, nuclear-armed world? How often is the first song we sing an honest song of lament when we hope that such lament will bring about the miracle of transformation and the advent of a new day? But here in this story, and perhaps in the work of life itself and in the ministry that we all share, we are invited not to lead with those truths, with those truths of our suffering and our brokenness and our scarcity, but to lead with another truth, our deep gratitude for all that is. for the weariness, because it is a sign of work well done. For the people we love, because they trust us enough to keep coming back with their problems and their questions even when we don't have answers. For the resources before us, because they just might be enough. For this day, because it is beautiful and holy, and no fear or suffering can wipe that away. He said thanks before the miracle happened. And in doing so, he replaced all that fear with gratitude. Now you know and I know that I'm not standing here to convince folks to believe in miracles of the supernatural sort. I'm not telling you that gratitude makes miracles happen, or that simply believing in yourself transforms the whole world into a bowl full of cherries. I'm saying that the apostles were afraid. They were governed by their fear and their sense of scarcity and their anxiety that there would never, ever be enough. And Jesus wasn't afraid. And that lack of fear, that steadfast refusal to get bogged down in anxiety about the lack of everything, that was the thing that turned the tide. Perhaps lack of fear is itself the miracle. And the presence of gratitude, even in the midst of scarcity, is the deepest lesson. My colleague Galen Gingrich has written that gratitude ought to be at the very core of who we are as Unitarian Universalists. In his words, gratitude should be the defining element of our faith. As Judaism is defined by tradition, Christianity by love, and Islam by sacred submission, we ought to be defined by gratitude. Because, he says, we perhaps uniquely in the religious world are well suited to see how deeply embedded we are in everything that came before us, and how much we owe to the entire universe for the very fact of our existence. It's not just God we have to thank, but our ancestors and plants and trees that fed them and the sun that shone and the air they breathed and the whole holy mess that coalesces to make all the beautiful things we know and have known. He says, gratitude links us to the past by revealing to us our identity, how we became who we are, and it links us to the future by revealing to us our duty, what we owe back in return. It requires of us a discipline of gratitude, constantly acknowledging our utter dependence on the sources that make life possible, and it demands of us an ethic of gratitude, working for a future in which all relationships among humans, as well as between humans and the physical world, are fair, constructive, and beautiful. Now, I think an ethic of gratitude tells us that if you're grateful for something, you can't discount it. And if you can't discount it, you can't destroy it. Indeed, you might even be called to protect it. In our theological framework, if we are creators of the future and we are created by the entire system of which we are a part, there is nothing, not even the tiniest molecule or the slightest breeze, that is insignificant. There is no element of creation that is not worthy of praise, since it brings into being every precious moment of our lives and the lives of those we love. For Unitarian Universalists, the world isn't divided into sacred and profane, into that which is of God and that which is of the earth, for the two are awfully like one another. And there is nothing so mundane that we get permission to ignore it entirely. There is holiness in every last thing, including our meager gifts and our little lives. And gratitude for the whole of which we are but a part has the power to shape us into more faithful participants in the universe that gives us birth. What you are grateful for, you cannot destroy. And what we are called to be grateful for is something very close to everything. And yet it has been difficult in these days. It has been difficult for some time now to look past scarcity and toward gratitude. Even in the presence of so much beauty and so much worth saving, it's really hard to get beyond the perception that there isn't enough. There isn't enough money, not only in many of our homes, but in our public service budgets and the national treasury and state and local coffers. There are not enough jobs. There is not enough progress and not enough effort and not enough great big barges to suck up all the oil pouring into our very limited Gulf Coast waterways. Not enough, not enough, not enough. And there are times when I feel like one of the apostles in this season of scarcity, standing over in the corner with you, my brethren, and gesturing wildly over our meager gifts as if to say, what will we do? What will we do when people are hungry and there is not enough to feed them and all we have are these few loaves and fishes and these tiny gifts and this limited time and there are so many, so many who need to be filled? But what happens when we are ruled by our sense of scarcity and our fear? What happens when we are so terribly afraid? We rush ahead with breathless speed to fill in the places that are empty and accumulate all that we perceive to be lacking. Fear of scarcity, I posit, is a supremely dangerous thing. And when we act out of that fear, really frightening things happen. The drive to accumulate more quickly and turn empty coffers into full bank accounts can give rise to irresponsibility and carelessness, and acting out of fear creates not only mistakes but disaster. What happens when we act too quickly out of our sense of scarcity? Oil wells are dug too fast, without oversight or caution or care. The welder in a hurry misses a spot. The engineer, fearful for his job and rushed to perform, overlooks a faulty plan. A company man turns the other way when the reports urge patience and orders that workers build it as fast as they can, get it pumping, fill those proverbial baskets, because the people are hungry and their mouths are wide open and the system must be fed and fast. The perceived crisis of scarcity drives the machine to turn faster and faster until it blows, and then and only then do people who move the system forward remember how beautiful the marshes are, how glorious the sky, how majestic the pelicans and pristine the beaches. Then and only then do they remember the hymn of praise they might have sung. Then, only then, after the driving force of fear and anxiety that there is not enough has led to destruction, do the people in power remember how grateful they should have been all along, and that what they had, if not everything, was plenty and enough. And can I get an amen from my amen corner? Fear feeds on fear, and scarcity feeds on scarcity, and it is a cycle that must be broken each and every time it rears its ugly head by someone who comes along and, like Jesus, invites us to take a deep breath, look at our little gifts, and instead of lamenting them, actually begin by giving thanks for them. Amen. Someone needs to turn the tide of our scarcity and our self-pity and our fear and our hurry and remind us that there we are and there we will be and there we have always been, blessed beyond measure. Even now, especially now, even if you have lost your home, even if you cannot find a job, and even if you hate the job you have and wonder if there is anything meaningful at all in the constant rise and fall of your days, especially now, when you know how beautiful a thing is only when it's threatened, how sacred your life is now that you have to fight for it, how precious your children are when they are the only thing you've got left, and how glorious the sunshine is when, without work, you have all the time in the world to soak it up. even in this time when scarcity is real, it has never been more important to give thanks for that which is laid out before us. Amen. To praise creation for all of its gifts, and to invite ourselves to be transformed by that gratitude. Because in truth, what we are surrounded by, we become. Fear and anxiety and scarcity presented in an endless loop seep into our bones and make a home there. If we let those real but limiting emotions be the driving force behind our actions, we will act not out of love but out of sheer desperation. And in the end, desperation feeds nobody and everybody goes home hungry. But gratitude for beauty, gratitude and praise can seep into our bones as well. They can make a home in us too. They can shape us and shape the way we see the world and the way we're called to act in it. Gratitude has the power to color the whole world with splendor. And if we practice it enough, in time we, like Jesus, might see with different eyes. Where others see only scarcity, the constant drumbeat of not enough, not enough, not enough, we might see beauty and grace and something worth saving. Instead of telling the people that they must surely starve and that change isn't possible, we will invite them and invite ourselves to sit down for dinner. And we will offer up whatever we have, meager as it may be, and know that there might even be some scraps left over. And so let us begin with gratitude, and may that gratitude pull us forward toward a transformed world where everyday miracles really do await, where there is enough meaning, enough food, enough purpose, enough work to sustain us as long as we are willing to continue the journey. He gave thanks first, and then the miracle happened. That's the point.